Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The battle has been raging for years, with many believing there was no end in sight. But last week, a shot heard round the country was fired.
Last night, a report disclosed that a conservative majority of the United States Supreme Court is ready to overturn Roe v. Wade and uproot decades of precedent affirming a woman's right to an abortion.
Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, for the first time in history, a draft opinion leaked from the United States Supreme Court indicating that they would be poised or could be poised to strike down Roe v. Wade, removing protections for abortion rights at the national level and allowing each state to decide for themselves on how to handle this controversial issue. What makes this frightening to the pro-choice side of the debate is about half the states, maybe more, are ready to end those protections. But this should also concern the pro-life side, because ending abortion creates more challenges than most can count, and presumably more than most have considered. In fact, it could be argued that the end of Roe changes everything. What would a post-Roe United States look like, be like? What would be the landscape here in North and South Carolina? To help us explore those questions, we're joined by Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of their weekly health policy podcast, What the Health? Welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Rebecca Kreitzer is Associate Professor of Public Policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She has studied abortion policy in the states extensively. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Seema Iyer is back with us. She's an attorney and chief legal correspondent for WJZY's Queen City News. Seema, thank you for being here again.
Thank you for having me.
So this was earth-shattering news, I think, almost everybody on both sides when it came out last week. Many were surprised, because although this has been used as a political weapon on both sides for years, I think both sides thought this would never happen, and here it comes. And nobody under the age of 50 remembers what the world was like before Roe, because they weren't alive. You saw this coming, Julie Rovner. You say the court telegraphed it in December when they first heard arguments in a Mississippi case concerning abortion. Talk about that.
Well, I've actually seen this coming for quite a long time. I've been covering this debate since the late 1980s, and you could see incrementally how the anti-abortion movement has been making gains, both at the federal level, in Congress with various abortion restrictions, at the state level, particularly since 2010, with even more restrictions, and at the court level, with the Supreme Court allowing certain restrictions, and obviously in the past several years, adding more conservative justices to the court who were going to make this possible. I mean, yes, last week's, you know, draft opinion landed like a shock, because we've never seen a draft opinion before. Things don't leak from the Supreme Court. But the fact that it said that was not a huge surprise to people who've been paying attention.
And you also say that no one truly has any idea what will happen if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. But wouldn't we simply revert back to the way things were before 73?
73.
Yeah.
Yes and no. I mean, the anti-abortion movement, you know, they've been a little bit quiet about it lately, but if you've been watching all along, you know that their goal is not simply to eliminate Roe and to turn this decision back to the states. Their goal is to eliminate abortion and to make abortion illegal nationwide. And we've had some, you know, early indications of that really over the weekend. And I've, you know, seen some leaders of some of the anti-abortion movement, you know, interviewed and saying this is just sort of the first step towards the final goal. So this will not end the fight. This will simply touch off a whole new round of fighting.
Julie mentioned the Seema, and much has been made by other people over the last several days about how this draft memo or this draft opinion was leaked to Politico, but that it is just a draft. And drafts are often changed. I don't know whether they completely reverse the original draft or not, but we have never gotten to see the sausage being made at the Supreme Court because these things aren't leaked. So internally, I don't know how much you know about this, but internally.
I do. I can tell you about
this. Okay. Are these draft opinions essentially trial balloons amongst the judges?
So there is a separate computer system that only certain people have access to, right? So, and that would be the justices as well as their law clerks. And each of them have four law clerks. And I don't know, perhaps more people have access to that, but it's an entirely different system. And it's highly regulated. It's very secure. You can't necessarily, transfer your draft opinion to your Gmail account so you can go home to work on it. Everything is very regulated and you can only work on the draft opinions or the opinions at certain times, at certain places, and this is all tracked. So also these law clerks, because you know there is speculation that the leak came from a law clerk, these law clerks take vows of confidentiality at the beginning of their terms. And at least from what has been reported, during their terms, their clerkships, the justices will reiterate that vow to the law clerk saying, okay, you took a vow. So this is a very disturbing type of breach. Also curious is why the Chief Justice has given this investigation to the Marshal. Thank you, Julie. The Marshal, because to me, you know, that's analogous to look at a prosecutor's office, right? Are you going to give it to another prosecutor in the same office to investigate another prosecutor? No, you're going to call in a special prosecutor, someone from outside the organization.
So in terms of process, though, are these trial balloons, are these sent from one justice who's writing the majority opinion, for instance, to all the other justices to see whether the argument holds water or whether the argument ought to be hardened or softened or changed in some way or even completely reversed? Here's my opinion. It may not be the final opinion, but here's what I think. What do you think? Is that how it works? Or do
well,
we know?
From what I understand, yeah. So I don't know the complete answer, but what I do understand is, so whoever's in the majority opinion, the most senior member, and that would be Clarence Thomas, he assigns the justice to write the opinion. So that's at least, I think, part of the process is that Thomas assigned this to Alito. And I also want to highlight to everyone that if you wanted some more forecasting, go back and look at the dissent of Obergefell, same-sex marriage case, because Alito definitely previewed what he was going to do here. Now, your question is, did Alito write the whole thing and then, you know, pass it around? I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. You've written
about the Chief Justice. I'm sorry, somebody's asking about the Chief Justice assigning this. From what I understand is whoever the majority vote is, that senior justice is the one who assigns who writes it.
I know this is a big deal. Wouldn't the Chief Justice have been in the majority if the vote was to uphold the Mississippi law?
This is good. Julie, I completely think people keep talking about that because technically the first quote unquote leak was to the Wall Street Journal editorial board on April 26th. Right. Okay. Julie's nodding. She's with me. And in that, and Julie, correct me if I'm wrong, but it indicated that Chief Justice Roberts was trying to get Kavanaugh or Barrett or both to almost get a moderate view and say, okay, you know what? We're going to uphold Mississippi, which is 15 weeks, and not overturn Roe v. Wade altogether.
So Julie,
right, but not to get too far into the weeds, but this has been something that's been bothering me since people have been talking about this last week. It's like,
oh yeah,
the original vote at the original conference, the court hears the oral arguments, which happened December 1st. And then usually at the end of that week, they have a conference and they take a preliminary vote. And I would have thought that the vote at that time wouldn't have been who wants to overturn Roe v. Wade. It's who wants to uphold the Mississippi law. And I would think that Roberts would have been in the majority.
But the problem was, because when Ginsburg passed away and Barrett got her seat, the problem was Mississippi, in their briefs, instead of answering the question presented, uphold our 15-week law, Mississippi said no, they were cowboys, and they said, let's just overturn Roe v. Wade. So that's what I think changed the conversation.
So, Julie, you have written about the court's process in making decisions, and you say that even if the underlying votes don't change, draft opinions are often changed significantly before they are released. There is a concern that's been bandied about in the news media about how this particular draft puts the court in a bad light. It kind of shines a political light on it and makes it a political body. I suppose that we can argue that all day. But now, if a ruling is released that significantly deviates from the draft, wouldn't that show the court responding to public opinion, which has been significantly negative on this, and that also would cast them in a political light?
Yeah, there's no question that this leak has done damage to the court as an institution. But I've been reminding people that had the February draft of the opinion in the Affordable Care Act case in 2012 been leaked, it would have shown that the Affordable Care Act was going to be declared unconstitutional. There, we know now from reporting, subsequent reporting, mostly by Joan Biskupic, who covers court for CNN, but who also wrote a lengthy biography of the Chief Justice, that actually there was basically a deal struck where the justices agreed to uphold the fundamentals of the Affordable Care Act, but to make the Medicaid expansion voluntary for the states. And that was a big change, and it happened later in the process. So things do, things can and do change. In this case, we're pretty confident that there are five votes to overturn Roe. What we don't know is whether they're all going to sign on to the reasoning that Justice Alito wrote back in February.
We know that the Supreme Court has reversed previous opinions in the past, not many times. The three nominees, though, the last three nominees to the High Court, during their appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee at their nomination hearings, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, all appeared to bow to the principle of stare decisis, in which the court accepts what previous decisions as settled law, and now let's move on. We've already decided that. Let's move on. And they leave those challenges intact. How often, Seema, have they departed from that principle?
These three or others?
Just the whole court in general, over history, over time.
I am not a historian, and I'm not Joan Biskupic.
Yes, but you can play one on radio.
But I do, I don't think it's happened very often. I am trying to remember, racial segregation. That was one. Plessy versus Ferguson, yes. Right? Like kind of like the separate but equal. They said, oh my God, we got that really wrong. So since then, I can't recall something besides that happens. And in fact, that's the reasoning they used in Casey, Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 92, is the stare decisis decision, because even some of the justices that ruled in favor of Casey and upholding abortion didn't necessarily agree with the constitutional arguments from Roe, but they agreed with the stare decisis.
So go ahead, Julie.
So just 2 years ago in the Louisiana abortion case, the Chief Justice actually upheld a lower court ruling that struck down the Louisiana law because it was so close to the Texas law that the court had struck down, a couple of years earlier. I mean, literally, they happened on the heels of each other. So that was one where the Chief Justice said he didn't agree with it, but it was important precedent.
Julie Robner with Kaiser Health News. When we come back, we'll take a look at how this may affect the states with Dr. Rebecca Reitzer. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the world following an overturning of Roe v. Wade, should that come to pass. Julie Rovner is here. She is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and the host of their What the Health podcast. Seema Iyer, the chief legal correspondent at WJZY's Queen City News. And Dr. Rebecca Kreitzer is associate professor of public policy at UNC Chapel Hill, who has studied this extensively at the state level. And Dr. Kreitzer, I know that you wanted to talk about what Justice Thomas said, I think it's latest Friday, about stare decisis, the principle of settled law not being overturned.
That's right. Just on Friday, Justice Thomas was speaking before the 11th Circuit Judicial Conference in Atlanta, and he said that the Supreme Court shouldn't be obligated to be bound by the judicial doctrine of stare decisis, which is a pretty radical statement. He said, and this is a quote, "We use stare decisis as a mantra when we don't want to think." And then he went on to say that unlike the lower courts, the Supreme Court is the end of the line. And so if the justices at the Supreme Court don't reevaluate, then who does? This is a radical departure from the longstanding doctrine of stare decisis. And it's a pretty shocking statement to say so explicitly about willingness to overturn what has been longstanding precedent.
Except for the fact, in the past, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not a historian either, in the past, the obliteration of or the ignoring of stare decisis has been used to overturn rulings that would correct the mistakes of the court. Most people today, if you look at the polling at least, the majority of the country today would say this is not overruling a mistake, this is making a mistake. Would that be accurate?
That's right. The most famous cases of overturning longstanding precedent would be things like the Dred Scott decision, the Plessy versus Ferguson. And so the idea is that when you overturn precedent, it's because of a grievous wrong that has been embedded into law. And that's not how the vast majority of Americans see the issue of abortion.
The fact that these justices, the last three to come before the Senate Judiciary Committee for their confirmation, Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett, were asked extensively in those hearings, because this is the litmus test for getting on the court, about their opinion on Roe v. Wade and their opinion of whether or not it is settled law. They all kind of either prevaricated on the issue or found a way to cleverly tap dance around it or lied. Susan Collins, the Republican from Maine who supports abortion rights, had a conversation with Brett Kavanaugh back in 2018 prior to his confirmation, and she said his opinion about Roe as president would influence her decision at the time about whether to back his nomination. Here's how she described that conversation to NBC News.
We talked about whether he considered Roe to be settled law. He said that he agreed with what Justice Roberts said at his nomination hearing, in which he said that it was settled law. We had a very good, thorough discussion about that issue and many others.
So, Seema, would that mean that he and possibly others lied to Congress in their hearings? And if so, are there ramifications? Is there any recourse?
Yeah. I was going to choose C, as in lying, when you gave us that multiple choice. I was also, the other option is that if they overturn Roe and the ultimate opinion says that there was a mistake in the reasoning of Roe, then those justices are going to point to that, saying, listen, we're all for stare decisis. However, the reasoning, the fundamental reasoning of Roe was wrong and that things have changed. Remember, in 1973, at that time, the viability was 28 weeks. And then the courts have recognized, okay, viability is now 23, 24 weeks. So if they can get out of that, now, is there a ramifications? Supreme Court justices could be impeached. I don't think that's going to happen.
No. So Dr. Kreitzer, you study American politics and public policy at the state level. In fact, your dissertation focused on the creation of abortion policy in the states. What have they been formulating in terms of that policy in the years since Roe v. Wade that made abortion legal in all 50 states? What have they been doing at the state level?
It's a really interesting history because we've seen the patterns of policy in the states change over time. So initially after Roe versus Wade, the anti-abortion rights movement realized that now that there was a constitutional right to abortion as precedent in the Supreme Court, they took on what might be called a strategy of an approach of strategic incrementalism. That is to say that they would keep passing policies that would carve away at the right to abortion in small ways. For example, adding in waiting periods or oftentimes misleading informed consent procedures or restricting certain procedures. But really none of them took aim at undermining the legal right to abortion as a whole. However, in recent years, we had started to see an increase in that. For example, we started to see the proliferation of introductions of constitutional amendments to identify personhood or statutes to identify personhood happening very early on, perhaps at the moment of conception or fertilization. And although those didn't pass initially, people started to get used to the idea of them. We sometimes call that softening up an idea in public policy. In the even more recent years, we've seen a big increase in the types of policies that will have a much bigger impact on the restriction of abortion. For example, changing the gestational age, requiring clinics to get licensure or do construction to make their clinics fit certain surgical center requirements. And these are much larger departures in terms of the effect they would have on abortion. But ever since Donald,
That's okay. No, finish.
Ever since Donald Trump got elected, then it was very clear that he was going to nominate a Supreme Court that was going to take aim directly at the right to abortion. And since his election, and even more after the new nominees were confirmed to the Supreme Court, we saw states say, this is an opportunity to reevaluate, and we will now try to pass policy that would have been seen as too radical and extreme in the 1970s.
And all of this has been happening at the state level, even as public opinion has been shifting more liberally, taking a more liberal view of abortion. How do you explain the states working in direct opposition to the changing ideals of Americans?
Well, I would say the first thing is that there's been a believability gap in that many people, I think many Democrats and even many Republicans, didn't really think the Supreme Court would ever actually go as far as to ban abortion or leave it entirely up to the states. And so Democrats and Republicans on both sides and for different reasons have not taken as clear of a stance on the issue of abortion because they just kind of assumed it wouldn't go so far. You raise the question of public opinion on abortion, and that's an incredibly complicated topic. Public polling on abortion shows that the way you ask the question shapes the answers you get even more than other public policy questions. So for example, there's big differences in terms of people who think that abortion should be legal because of the Supreme Court versus what they actually think under certain situations or scenarios. So to summarize kind of what public opinion is, the vast majority of Americans think that abortion should be legal with some restrictions. Only somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 15% think that it should be completely illegal with no exceptions. And there's a larger section of the population that thinks that abortion should be legal in every single situation. But really, the vast majority of Americans are in the middle. And the majority of Americans say that Roe versus Wade should not be overturned and that there should be a legal right to abortion.
And yet, in the last 7 days since this draft opinion leaked, Julie, there have been people at the state level scrambling to get ready for the end of Roe and change their laws to reflect what they think is the right way to go on this. And somebody in one of the states, and I've forgotten which one, wants to outlaw any kind of situation beyond. They say that life begins at conception. Others have talked about life being viable at certain other stages, weeks out, etc. Why, since you report on health news, why hasn't the medical community, or maybe they have, come up with a definition for when life definitively begins?
Yeah, I think I did my first story on when life begins and how there was no agreed upon definition. in the early 2000s, and I think I did it again several years later. I mean, this is something that keeps changing. The medical community has its own difficult history with abortion. One of the main reasons abortion is illegal in the United, or was illegal in the United States until 1973, is because the American Medical Association worked to have states pass laws to make it illegal so they could push midwives and other sort of non-medical doctor practitioners out of the practice of childbirth. These were, you know, a bunch of mostly white men who wanted to basically solidify their power over the medical profession. And they were the ones who were behind the passage of most of the abortion bans in the United States. The AMA has obviously come around to a different point of view. Now they're unhappy about the idea of politicians practicing medicine, as they say. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has long been sort of more in favor of abortion rights. There's a lot of concerns about how doctors will be trained to do procedures that are not technically abortions, but that frequently are important medical procedures, like D&Cs after a miscarriage. So the medical profession is active, but again, they've had their own, you know, conflicts. And like many Americans, you know, individual medical practitioners are divided on this issue.
Rebecca, what are the implications of the Supreme Court overturning Roe in the face of public opinion? In other words, this would be essentially a minority opinion riding roughshod over a majority opinion. What are the implications of that nationwide?
The implications are pretty consequential. But if I may, I just want to push back slightly on something that Julie just said, which is that there's a lot of procedures like D&Cs that happen after miscarriages that are akin to abortion. Those are abortions. A lot of people don't realize that certain procedures in terms of miscarriage management, if you have an ectopic pregnancy, people dance around the word and they say things like termination or a medical procedure. But the reality is those are abortions. And it's important that we recognize them as such, because that is what is at stake. Your question has to do with the institution and institutional legitimacy. Over time, the public has generally had a high degree of confidence in the Supreme Court compared to our other institutions like the executive, the presidency, and Congress. But we've seen in recent years a growing recognition of the political nature of the Supreme Court. I'd add here that throughout history, the Supreme Court and really all of our courts have been political bodies. Nevertheless, in recent years, we're seeing, and in even recent months, we're seeing that there's been a decline in faith in the institution of the Supreme Court. And honestly, I'm not sure what that will bring, because we haven't seen such a conflict or a crisis of legitimacy in the Supreme Court before. And this is something that some of the Supreme Court justices, like Sonia Sotomayor, kind of hinted at a couple of months ago.
Many of the states, Julie, have these so-called trigger laws that are set to go into place the instant Roe v. Wade is overturned. Other states are rushing to put such laws into place, while blue states are rushing to cope with their ability to handle the influx and protect the ability of women to get abortions in those states. What is the likely upshot of all of that in terms of the options that women will face who want or feel the need to have an abortion?
Well, it's important to remember that abortion in many parts of the country is effectively unavailable now, that there are huge what are called abortion deserts, where it can be hundreds of miles between abortion providers. And, you know, as we've pointed out, states have implemented waiting periods. And so you have to come back two or three different times, even to have, you know, a very early abortion. So it is difficult from just a resource point of view for many women to obtain an abortion now. But obviously, if this opinion were to be the final opinion or something near to it, it would be kind of a free-for-all. I mean, you have a number of states, as you say, with trigger laws, who've passed laws in recent years that say if Roe is ever turned, then if Roe's ever overturned, abortion will become illegal. You have something called zombie laws, where states had bans in effect before Roe v. Wade was decided, that Roe v. Wade basically made inoperable, that could become operable again. And then you have states that are going to rush to actually pass new bans. Sorry about the dogs. Those are mine.
It's okay. Senator Schumer said on the floor last Tuesday that it was his intention to hold a vote on legislation to codify the right to an abortion. And he said at the very least, that would show America where senators stand on this. He's putting them on the spot, I guess. Susan Collins, who favors abortion, has said that she will vote against this bill. So, Seema, does this have any chance of passage, or is this just show business politics?
Okay, so for what I understand, it is called the Women's Health Protection Act. I'm sure Dr. Kreitzer knows a lot about this as well. But because it's a regulatory measure, it would require 60 votes, and it doesn't seem like they will get to that. And it is also one of those bills that is subject to the filibuster. So it doesn't seem like it's going to work.
So, Rebecca,
they've had this vote already this year. They had this bill passed the House last year. They voted on it in February. But it also, this is a bill that doesn't just codify Roe v. Wade. It would eliminate a lot of the restrictions that do have a fair bit of public support, like minors, parental involvement in minors' abortion decisions.
Given the fact that this has little chance of passage, if it were to pass, Rebecca, if the Republicans take over the Congress, wouldn't they just repeal the law? Wouldn't it? And if not, wouldn't a whole new barrage of lawsuits be created at the states to take this back to the Supreme Court yet again and get that law overturned?
Absolutely. And that's why protecting Roe through a statutory policy passed by Congress is not as secure as recognizing it as a fundamental right implied by the number of privacy rights in the Constitution.
But how do you do that?
Yeah, if the Supreme Court is not willing to recognize it, obviously, it's important to pause here and say that what is constitutional very substantially depends on who is currently on the Supreme Court at this current moment. And so it could mean that a future Supreme Court would just say that this decision, which has not yet become final, is incorrectly decided. However, I think it's very likely that if it by some odd chance it were statutory protection of Roe and Congress were to pass, certainly the Republicans would undo that very quickly. As Seema said, it currently requires a filibuster, which is a supermajority. And again, it's worth pausing here to say that no other parliament in the world requires a supermajority for regular legislation as the Senate does in the U.S. And the Democrats have indicated they're not willing to get rid of the filibuster over this issue, but it wouldn't surprise me if the Republican Party were willing to get rid of the issue of willing to get rid of the filibuster in order to restrict abortion.
This isn't just about what we normally think of as a woman getting an abortion. This has tentacles into wide-ranging areas of medicine, including the possible criminalization of procedures that most people believe to be absolutely necessary for the life of the mother. We'll talk about that and some other things when we come back with Julie Rovner from Kaiser Health News, Dr. Rebecca Kreitzer from UNC Chapel Hill, and Seema Iyer from WJZY's Queen City News. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a possible world after the possible repeal of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court with Julie Rovner, Chief D.C. Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Dr. Rebecca Kreitzer, Associate Professor of Public Policy at UNC Chapel Hill, and Seema Iyer, Chief Legal Correspondent for WJZY Queen City News. There are almost, Rebecca, too many aspects of what may happen after Roe to talk about in 1 hour, but one of them is how this may criminalize pregnancy. If you have a miscarriage, you might be investigated for having had an abortion or doing it deliberately. In states where they want to go after anyone who helps a woman get an abortion, there's also the aspect that I don't think many people have talked about, and that is the fact that your phone is a tracking device. So they know where you have been, or they can discover that, and they know where anybody who may have helped you may have been. It's leaving a data trail every second. Talk about that.
I think you're absolutely right to talk about the criminalization of pregnancy, though I would say that the criminalization of pregnancy has already been going on. We've seen that women are prosecuted for miscarriages or for negative pregnancy outcomes, and there are criminal charges levied against women. And it's really important to emphasize that the prosecution of women for their pregnancy outcomes is not even across the population. And in fact, women of color are much more likely to face criminal prosecution and attention because of miscarriages or alleged self-abortions. And so I think that we will definitely see an increase in the number of self-managed abortions and self-sourced managed abortions, which means people who are getting, for example, medication abortions online. But there is a real danger because there is a digital trail when you are getting information, even information about pills or purchasing pills online through the internet, on your phone, et cetera. And we have real concerns about the protection of privacy when it comes to things like that. And I'm not sure that the state governments and police officers and the criminal legal system will respect people's privacy when it comes to this issue.
And in fact, as I understand it, this opinion calls into question the right to privacy, not just with regard to abortion, but it would extend out beyond that should this come to pass. It seems to me, Julie, that many, in their zeal to have Roe v. Wade overturned, even those who want this to happen may not have completely thought through the consequences of this and how it may impact many different areas of life in America. We don't have the resources to handle the need for prenatal care and post-birth situations where the women who wanted to have these abortions because they can't afford a child now have one to deal with. And I don't know that we have things in place to take care of that. Do we?
The Congressional Budget Office, even just looking at things like defunding Planned Parenthood, found that unintended births would go up, that many of those children and their mothers would then be eligible for Medicaid. It would cost the states and the federal government more money. I mean, this is a large undertaking of women who would have, who would give birth who otherwise wouldn't. Now, one thing we do know from history is that whether or not abortion is illegal, abortion happens. Women do terminate their pregnancies, and they just do it more safely if it's legal than if it's illegal. And the numbers are sort of surprisingly similar, that women who do not wish to be pregnant find ways to not be pregnant, some of them safer than others.
Because this could extend, as I understand it, not just to the act of going to a clinic and getting an abortion. It could extend to the morning after pill. It could ultimately extend to the IUD.
Well, that goes back to this issue of when does life begin? And that was why I sort of have explored this topic from time to time, because if you believe that life begins at fertilization, mm-hmm. which is not medically when pregnancy begins, at implantation, when that fertilized egg implants in a woman's uterus, that's when pregnancy begins. Although doctors will say pregnancy begins when they can detect it, which is sometimes even a little bit later than that. But if you believe that life begins at fertilization, then any birth control method that prevents a fertilized egg from implanting in the womb is therefore to you an abortion. And this is where the questions come into play about things like the IUD. It turns out that's not how the morning after pill works, but there is a sort of lingering belief that it is. So there's concern about the morning after pill. And obviously the morning after pill is very different from the abortion pill. The abortion pill does interrupt an existing pregnancy. The morning after pill merely prevents ovulation. So that it prevents that from having an egg that is ready to be fertilized.
So we appear not to have the resources for what may happen when abortion is outlawed, and we don't have the money, and there are certainly tax and taxpayer consequences to that, because we'll find that out pretty soon. But there are also states, Rebecca, who will be rushing to codify the ability of a woman to get an abortion, and that means not only will the citizens of that state be able to get them, but they may experience an influx of people coming in from other states where it is not legal. Does any state have the resources or the infrastructure to handle that?
That's a great question. And there, it's also important to say that this decision and the attack that we're seeing on the legal right to abortion, it's much bigger than abortion. This is just the beginning. And we've already seen the Republicans take a concerted effort for many years to restrict access to affordable family planning. And so we've seen that there are contraception deserts as well as abortion deserts where people can't even get the means to prevent pregnancy. What we are seeing is that there are states that are working just as fast as conservatives in other states to try to codify or further solidify the legal right to abortion, either in their state statutes or in their state constitutions. But we're also seeing that some states that already have constitutional protections to abortion, for example, in Kansas, trying to undo that constitutional right to abortion. Nevertheless, it will become like many rights that we have in the US, which is to say it's increasingly polarized. Women of means have always had access to abortion even before Roe versus Wade. It just meant that they would oftentimes have to travel across the country. And we're already seeing that today. Many clinics across the U.S. are reporting that as many as 30% of their clients in the last few weeks have been from Texas. That's even before the Oklahoma law went into effect. And so we'll just continue to see, and this pressure will be unsustainable for other states, for the abortion clinics in other states. So here we are in North Carolina. Many of our neighboring states are very likely to make abortion illegal or mostly illegal. And so North Carolina will be one of the few places in the South where there is a legal right to abortion, though that also depends on the upcoming election and whether or not there becomes a supermajority. So can the clinics in North Carolina take on the women and the pregnant people from all of the states surrounding us? I think that will be a very big stress on the existing infrastructure.
You just brought up the election. This is happening because of a previous election. Merrick Garland was denied a hearing by Mitch McConnell when President Obama had an opportunity. So that left three appointees to be appointed by Donald Trump, who was elected not by the people, but by the Electoral College. So elections matter. And as you pointed out, in this state, although Governor Roy Cooper has said he's a Democrat, has said that he will veto any bill that comes before him that would curtail abortions in North Carolina, if the Republicans achieve a supermajority in the legislature in the November election, he loses that ability. He can't veto a supermajority vote. Seema, there are those people who say that this opinion, as currently drafted, has implications that go well beyond abortion to other rights that we just take for granted in America. Do you agree with that assessment? And if so, what are we talking about here?
I do agree with that, because the fact that the right to have an abortion isn't explicitly listed. Although the arguments for that liberty, that comes under the 14th Amendment. And then they also make arguments under the 9th Amendment. The 9th Amendment says, beyond specific enumerated rights, we still have other individual rights. And that's where people have laid their argument. And for me, the strongest argument is under the 4th Amendment, and that is the right to be secure in our person, our personhood. And that, to me, a large part is where you get this right to do what you want with your body. However, what you know you're intimating is that if this right is taken away, then other types of cases will look to this case and say, if you don't say precisely what that liberty is, and if that isn't codified, then we lose that right because it's not specific in the Constitution. And there is a danger.
And in fact, doesn't the Constitution say that all of the rights not enumerated by the Constitution belonging to the federal government are the property of the states, essentially?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So some say, Doctor, that they will come after a birth control next. Then they will move on to same-sex marriage, even possibly interracial marriage. That seems highly unlikely, but then so did the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So are there any indications in your research about policy at the state level that any actors have been working to implement those kinds of changes in the absence of Roe v. Wade or in light of this ruling, or is it too soon to tell?
It's absolutely right to see these issues as connected, because for one, they reference each other in their cases, but they're built on the same precedent, which is this idea of a right to privacy in our own homes, which is based off of contraceptive cases from the 1970s. It also ties into the right to legal sodomy, which occurred in 2003. So many people are talking about which rights will be implicated here. It's worth noting that the draft says this will only affect abortion and it won't affect any of these other rights. But I think that we should interpret that with kind of a wink and a nod to the people in state legislatures, because I don't think that's a very believable claim. Now, I do think that it's very possible that we will see states try to regulate the availability of same-sex marriage. We've seen actors in state legislatures propose that as an idea. We even see an amicus brief written by the Texas SB8 author that led to that. Now, do I think that'll really get overturned? It's really hard to say. There's a clear equal protection clause. It's, you know, argument to be made in terms of same-sex marriage. Now, I don't think it's as likely that interracial marriage is at stake, and that's in part because just the politics of race. And currently facing the Supreme Court are other cases like affirmative action, and there's in fact a case from UNC Chapel Hill that's being challenged. I think it's much more likely that the Supreme Court will have a ruling that says that there can't be any laws that make distinctions on the basis of race in order to strike down things like affirmative action. And so for that reason, while I do think that things like contraception, the right to not be legally sterilized, the right to gay sex, the right to same-sex marriage, I think those are more at risk than the right to interracial marriage. Hmm.
Julie, doctors have given out prescriptions of all sorts for all kinds of conditions for years, and have performed procedures for all kinds of things for years, all of which are protected by HIPAA. Wouldn't the revealing of a woman getting an abortion or being prescribed a contraceptive, wouldn't that revelation be in violation of HIPAA rules?
I think people misunderstand how HIPAA works. That's the health privacy law. It binds the medical providers from allowing your information to be made public, but it doesn't bind the information from being made public by other means. That's, we were talking earlier about, you know, things that you could track on your phone. Your phone and your phone carrier are not covered entities under HIPAA. If your doctor uses, in fact, this is one of the reasons why a lot of doctors don't use email. And when they do, they use special security emails, because the doctors themselves are responsible for making sure the information doesn't get out. But the phone carriers are not. So it's, you know, just because the healthcare providers and insurers and people who pay healthcare bills, those are the only ones who are actually bound by the law to keep your medical information private.
And we've seen in recent years that it's the oftentimes health professionals that have reached out to police in order to report people who have had a self-managed abortion or a suspicious miscarriage that might be because of drug use or something else. So despite
that's
the fact
because
that
because of the that's because of the immediate danger of the situation. So there is some language about HIPAA. Yeah, if somebody's in immediate danger, then they have the right to contact police.
So Kendall emails, one of our listeners, emails, where are the lawsuits and strategies and media discussions about the true constitutional violation here, the separation of church and state? Seema?
The separation of church and state. That's a great question, Kendall. Is that her name?
You don't have an answer.
I don't have an answer. I need to drink water to buy some time. Separation of church and state. I think she deserves an answer. And I think the best answer I could give at this point is that was already decided in 1973. And actually the case before that was it Gideon versus Connecticut or something? That case. Yeah. Dr. Kretzer is nodding. But so I think that it was already in a way waived, right? Because if you're bringing your issue of abortion, your body into the court, then you essentially are waiving any right to argue church and state. You're bringing that in front of the court.
The separation of church and state is also not in the Constitution. So a lot of people think that's actually not in our founding documents. That phrase comes from a private letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote.
You say, Doctor, that although the fight to end abortion on a national level has been led by Republican women, it is obviously Republican men because they're the majority of the legislators putting these rules in place. Is this a religious issue? Is it a control issue? Is it merely a hot button issue for politicians? And I only have 30 seconds.
Well, I would say it's all of the above. But one important thing is that abortion has been for ever since 1973, the single issue voter. So among people who are single issue voters, abortion is the thing. And it's been a really remarkable tool for increasing turnout among Republicans, especially in conservative areas. So I think fundamentally a big part of this is politics.
Dr. Rebecca Kreitzer, who studies public policy at the state level at UNC Chapel Hill, Seema Iyer, chief legal correspondent for WJCY, Queen City News, and Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.